Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out the Wait, What If podcast. I am your host, Kevin Sullivan. With us tonight is a gentleman by the name of Jesse. I for some reason, I don't think he wants me to say his last name. This is like the second guest that I've had this summer that's like, yeah, don't use my last name. So I'm starting to think it's me. People don't want to get associated with this wonderful, wonderful platform. I can't talk. What the hell? This is like the end of my day, and I've already gone. Every podcast is like this. I mean, save for a few that I did in the afternoon. But when I'm recording this, I've like put two kids to bed. I've worked all day, and then it's time for me to somehow turn on some brain power and have a coherent conversation. And I drink a little whiskey to boot. So add all that together, and I stumble over my words and stuff, and sometimes thoughts don't come out right. But whatever. Anyways, so yeah, Jesse. Jesse's going to be on tonight because I was on Facebook and I saw this guy that travels around the United States and I think the world, but he'll clarify that for us. Anyways, he travels around the United States and by voting. So on Twitter, he'll be like, hey, should I go to Big Bend or Jackson Hole or, you know, Mount Rushmore, and then everyone will vote on where he goes, and then he just heads out there. And I thought that was pretty cool because he started off with like three people following him and voting. And then now he's gotten like, I don't know, 15,000 followers. So check him out. He is at a Wayward One, and I'll put links on the show notes there. And that's his Twitter, a Wayward One. He doesn't have any blog or anything like that yet, but by the time this comes out, this is a few weeks from. I'm recording this at the beginning of August, so this is probably September this is coming out. Maybe he's got one by then. I don't know. He's a good writer. I like following his tweets. So I think he's going to have a good story. So let's take a listen.
You're listening to the Wait, What If podcast.
With us tonight is Jesse. He has been traveling United States, correct? This whole project United has been States. United States.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to I went to Newfoundland, so I guess you could add Canada to that.
Yeah, okay. So we'll say the Northwestern hemisphere.
Exactly.
but I thought it was cool because at night, really, I get most of my interviewees via just going through Twitter and finding out who's got an interesting story out there. And you had put up, or maybe it was one of your old tweets or whatever, you would put up a poll, you know, where should I go? Should I go? And you put a list down there, and I thought, hey, that's pretty cool. So I started going through your old tweets, and I'm like, man, I got to get this guy on the show. So with that said, you know, give us a background of it. What made you decide to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons why I decided to do it. I mean, first and foremost, I had recently left my job, so I had a lot of free time. I mean, that's always key to having the freedom to kind of travel based on the whims of social media. Mm-hmm. That's not that I know that it's ever been done before, but yeah, I had recently left my job. I had traveled the world pretty extensively over my, I guess, 8-year career in consulting.
Mm-hmm.
I was an international strategy consultant, so I've been all over the world doing strategy for large American companies and getting into those sort of second and third tier countries to sell their products.
So so when you say strategy, yeah. Like marketing strategy or what type of strategies?
I mean, we kind of ran the gamut. I mean, I guess my specialty would have been market entry strategy. So
Okay. If
Coca-Cola or Molson Coors or somebody wanted to get into XYZ country in Africa, in Asia, they would send us as basically an advanced team in there to kind of get the lay of the land, Okay. Talk to the key players within the industry, and start, you know, collecting as much data as possible. And then we would go back home to Boston, where I'm from, and kind of put together like the initial outlines of, you know, what they need to do and when.
Okay. It doesn't sound like your typical corporate job. Did you enjoy it when you did it?
Oh, absolutely. I loved it.
Okay.
I started in 2009. I got the job, and that was pretty much the height of the financial crisis. I got the job via a Craigslist ad. And I responded to that Craigslist ad and ended up working with this guy. And he became essentially, or I became his partner in this venture. And we sort of built this company into what it was or what it is today. So it's been a wild ride.
Do you have a degree? Do you have a degree in
marketing? Yeah, I got a master's in business.
Okay.
Graduated right at 2008.
Okay.
That's
a rough time, man. They're throwing you right out into the world when it's literally collapsing. I remember I was working at Duke Medicine, and I would go out of the clinic and look up at they had a TV going, and just every day it was like watching the market just crumble. And I was like, well,
yeah, I didn't have good timing there. So I graduated and essentially temped for a while at some financial institutions, which was, you know, my ultimate goal. Actually, it was venture capital, but because of the market conditions, I wasn't able to get anything. And a lot of other people, especially in that graduating class, were also sort of struggling to find work. And I actually played poker for a living for a while.
Did you?
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. So that filled the gap between 2008 and 2009.
You're a young guy. What drove you away from poker? You would think a lot of guys would kill to do that for a living.
I mean, poker is not a great life. I mean, there's some romance to it. There's some the sums of money that exist in the poker world that sort of get bandied around are big, but at the end of the day, 90% of the people are sitting at a table with a bunch of essentially degenerate gamblers,
right,
in a smoke-filled casino, or sitting in front of their computers trying to play 8 tables at once. I mean,
yeah,
it wasn't something that I had aspired to. It was sort of a stopgap.
Right. Did you play in college, or what gave you your skills?
I actually after I graduated university, undergrad, I moved out to Las Vegas for a year right after.
Okay.
Didn't go into the workforce, went out to Vegas and played out there for a year. I mean, on and off. I had some other things going on too, but so I learned it then back in 2000, 2001, another essentially economic downturn.
Yeah.
And, eventually I got my senses and moved back to the East Coast, got a real job in biotech, of all things, because I was a biology major.
Hmm.
And then ended up going to business school.
Okay.
And after that, 2009, landed this really unique and probably once-in-a-lifetime experience gig at this essentially firm of two people that we grew into about 50 people.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, your story is painted with a different brush than the typical American story, which is kind of neat. It kind of gives me an idea of who you are and why you kind of do your thing that you're doing now. When you were in poker, did you notice I was in the Air Force, and we flew, you know, a lot of high risk missions and stuff. And there's a bit of like, and I guess you see this with journalists too. When you do a job that is high risk, whether it's putting your life on the line or losing a lot of money, it's kind of the same genetic response that you get. It can be addicting. And when people go, I mean, there's the typical gambling addiction, but there's also the people who they get away from it and they miss it. You know, they miss the danger. Did you find that you were getting into that area where you needed that sort of rush or that risk?
I don't know. I mean, maybe subconsciously. Consciously, I was like, this is not the life I want. This is not a long-term strategy. I still like to go out to play poker, or, you know, if it ever becomes legal online again, I might play, but I think it was more subconscious.
Yeah.
But I think there are people that are risk takers in a way.
Right.
And that could be based on hardware or software. So it could be, you know, genetic being the hardware, or it could be conditioned. You know, you could have experiences that lead you along that way, I'd say.
That's right. Opportunity kind of presents itself when you look for it. If you're waiting for it, I mean, every now and then you hear the story how something, you know, finds somebody, but most of the time you got to get out there and look for it. You had mentioned in your email that there's got to be some sort of genetic component of it in our DNA. The cavemen who actually took risks and went out were rewarded with either food or water or a mate or whatever it is. And I think that's very true with us today.
Yeah. Well, I wrote it for a reason, so I think we agree on that for sure.
Yeah. So you were doing the other gig where you were working for that company. You grew it up to 50 people, and then what happened? Life change, or you're just...
I mean, I don't want to get into too many of the details, but the company got bought, and I felt like I was ready for my next challenge. So maybe that gets back to... you know, seeking out the next opportunity, not waiting for it in a way.
Right.
So I offered my resignation. They reluctantly accepted it, and here I am, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to, I've learned in life that, you know, shitty things are going to happen. I mean, not that this was shitty for you, but you know, things are going to happen in your life where you have to take a big change, and it's scary as hell. Like when you make a huge change, it's like you're going into the abyss, really. And
yeah,
I think, you know, people can attribute it to whatever they want, you know, was it meant to be or anything like that? And that's hard to say, but when you look back on it, it tends to be the better things that happen in your life. Like I met my wife because I decided to fly airplanes. I mean, I didn't have to fly airplanes, right? They gave me the opportunity, and I was sitting there like, you know, should I do it? And I said, oh, what the hell? And if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be where I am today.
No, exactly.
I suppose that's true with anything, right? I mean, had I not flown airplanes, yeah, I would be saying the same thing.
You'd be saying about some other activity or sort of passion that you had.
I'd be like, man, if I flew, I wouldn't have my wife and my mansion out here in the hills. So you started this, you only had a few followers at first,
right?
And this was what, back in May?
Yeah, I started in May. It was like this thing that, you know, what are you going to do now kind of thing.
Right.
And I'm getting married in August, and I had this, you know, I guess it was 5 or 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, let's do something productive. Let's not, you know, sit around, or, you know, let's not get the resume ready just yet. Let's go out and take a look what's out there. I mean, there was a lot of questions. I mean, I had been around the world, but I hadn't seen the U.S. I hadn't been to a lot of the places that, you know, that are the, you know, the gems of the United States, and like Grand Canyon. I hadn't been to Zion, and I ended up going to those places. But it really started out as I got a rental car.
Okay.
So there's a lot of variables that go into these decisions, right? So
sure.
I actually found a rental car that I could rent for 30 days for like $300 or $400. It was like a bargain basement rate.
Right.
And I said, let's see what happens out there. And when I started, I had no followers. I started from scratch. And I think my future wife was one of them, and she voted sort of religiously on where I go. And two other people also voted. And I sort of just weaved my way west from Boston based on those recommendations, based on those polls.
Are you a Boston native?
I'm from Vermont. I grew up in Vermont.
Okay.
So a lot of the people in Vermont sort of gravitate to Boston's closest city.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of nothing up in Vermont. I grew up in New Hampshire, so I was just around.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so we're rivals.
That's right. Yeah, I was over because Vermont's an upside down New Hampshire, and you might say it the other way. New Hampshire's an upside down Vermont, but Yeah, I grew up in New Hampshire, and then after New Hampshire, I headed straight to Boston. I lived over in Davis Square in Somerville.
Oh yeah, that's where we had our first office. So.
Oh okay. Yeah. It was fun. When I think about it, there's things I miss, but I think it's more a longing for just youth, basically. Like when I think back, when I lived in Davis Square, all the fun we would have, but it was all based on, I was working in the financial district, and I was freaking miserable. I was in a cubicle working in finance in 2001. So the market was, I believe it was tanking and just rebounding at that point. It just finished tanking, it was rebounding. But I was like, "What? This can't be life. This can't be it.
This isn't it." Yeah.
Yeah. And And then when I look at it, I'm like, what actually do I miss? I mean, it might be a little bit of freedom. It might be, I don't know. I guess without thinking about my life and thinking just about, the actual location, there's a lot of energy in cities, there's a lot of people, you can feel it. And I think if you haven't lived in a big city, you should definitely give it a try. If you decide to stay there, I don't know. It's, you stayed, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I did. And, I love Boston, but I think you hit on a good point there, which is cities offer something that, some other places might not, which is vast new experiences almost within walking distance.
Right.
So you have plenty of new restaurants, plenty of new, thousands, millions of new people. You have limitless possibilities in the city, whereas in other places you may not.
Yeah.
So I definitely agree with that point.
Do you like the desolation? And I'm referring to your traveling. When you go to travel, is it like a break? Does your brain just kind of go, ah?
I don't know. I mean, I think in some sense, it's a compliment to it. Yeah. It's something that I was just driving around the city, and it's a night, if you're driving around here, it's a nightmare. If you're commuting, it's a nightmare. There's a lot of things about cities that are congested, can feel overwhelming and so forth. But there's also that energy, and there's that, there's these new experiences around every corner in many ways. But to complement that, I also definitely enjoy just being alone, getting out there, being on my own, kind of being self-sufficient, not knowing what the next corner will hold behind it, not knowing where the next road will lead,
right?
Not knowing, what's going to be in that dive bar that I go into in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
So I think, in my mind, I think they complement each other, that overwhelming, in many ways, social aspect of cities or congestion.
Right.
And then the complement being just being by yourself and being totally self-sufficient out there. And I think probably need both in many ways.
Yeah. I think there might be something at, the subatomic level of human consciousness that enjoys or that knows that you're around people. I can't really put my finger on it, but things happen in groups. There's a feeling when you're in groups. I mean, when I feel it, if I'm home, your body can tell if you're home alone or if someone's home with you, at least I can. And I think when you're in a city, you kind of experience that to the nth degree.
No matter how separated you build your walls around you, how you separate yourself from it.
I was out in Nevada, flat, empty. I think I had sent an email about this, but there was no one around. I mean, literally every direction. You've been out there, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Drove through. Yeah.
Okay. Where you look in one direction, you see a little mountain range. You look to the left, there's a mountain range, and then you just got these giant valleys or this these open plains on either side. And one thing I remember about that is, because I was riding my bike, I got off my bike, and you may hear wind, but the silence actually has, there's like a weight to it. And yeah. I don't know if it's just the way that I perceived it, but it's, I guess I have no other way to describe it. There's like a weight to it. You get out there and you feel, even though you're completely alone, you feel almost blanketed in the energy of nature.
Yeah, no, I definitely feel that as well. Especially, I mean, it's not limited to the, you know, to the deserts of Nevada. I think you can go into the forest and feel that. I feel getting far away,
right,
is part of the human experience as well. Like being out there, it's almost impossible to describe.
I was just having trouble coming up with the word for it, but
yeah, there's something there. And I think that, you know, what you're describing also, I felt, and I think you kind of internalize that. You bring that into your personality in many ways, whatever it is or however you would describe it. So it becomes a little bit a part of you.
And we limit our experience to what we can see, right? We have a sky, we have the ground, and then we have whatever's around us. But those are all just objects of observation. You know, there really is nothing disconnecting you from the rest of the universe at that point, especially when you're laying down and looking up at the stars. You know, you feel like they're right there and you're here. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, there is no there and here. It's all just you're experiencing this, whatever this is. I used to be a very, very black and white thinking. You know, I was a flyer. I flew airplanes. I was very no gray area, right? And
yeah,
it wasn't until I got into meditation and yoga and kind of doing some inward searching that I realized the connection to everything that's more than just me. You know, there isn't just black and white anymore. There's a lot of gray out there, especially when it comes to experiences.
Yeah. No, I don't think, I haven't done the yoga or the meditation, but I definitely feel like, on these travels, you know, you change, like something in you changes, your software, going back to that analogy, changes. Your personality will change. Your interaction with other humans will change.
Yeah.
I think it's all for the good. Yeah. I think it's really good.
I don't think people get away from it as much because we're connected. We're so connected right now. Just as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at an iPhone. I have an iPad up, which I'm recording on. To my left is a Surface Pro. To my right is a Galaxy S8. I mean, I'm wearing a freaking smartwatch. I mean,
yeah,
we are
yeah.
just so connected all the time. And I don't know what it's going to do with us in the long run.
Well, I mean, you can kind of see signs of it, right? You can see this, you know, this, I don't know if it's an addiction, but this like feeling of nakedness when you don't have this anxiety with people that don't have their device next to them, that don't have, you know, Wi-Fi or it's a high speed internet or,
yeah.
So I think you're beginning to see the signs that time will tell, but in my mind, you kind of gotta extract yourself from that every now and then.
Right.
And most of it's good, but if you get caught into that trap, it's probably not good.
I think the good thing is the exchange of ideas and the opening of minds or the acceptance of people.
Absolutely.
Me and you are talking about, 800 miles apart right now, yet it looks like we're in the same room and we're not alone because there's thousands of people floating around here listening to this conversation, you know, whether it's in 2 weeks or 5 weeks or in 2 years, people can listen to this conversation and kind of take part. And that's my favorite thing about technology is just increasing the human discussion. I mean,
it's overwhelming. It's overwhelmingly positive. It's overwhelmingly positive, but it's not something, I guess my point is it's not something that you should rely on all the time.
Yeah.
And maybe you should take measures to extract yourself from it every now and then, I'd say.
Yeah.
But I'm on Twitter. I'm tweeting about my travels. So
yeah,
I definitely am with you in terms of the sharing of ideas, the sharing of content, the sharing of even the contribution of people into the voting as to where I go. The contribution of people who recommend places is amazing.
Yeah,
I love that part of it, because people are so prideful in their recommendations and in their hometowns often. So
that's true. AAA can't tell you where the hole in the walls are, right?
No. Yeah. That's with the consolidation of search engines. You type in a destination, you've got five answers, and everybody's going to go to those five places, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody's going to look around that corner to find that thing that, you know, is going to blow your mind, or it's not. Yeah. I mean, there's going to be a lot of places, a lot of times where you're not going to find anything, but that's also valuable.
I'm pretty sure the Beacon Hill Pub isn't on any highly recommended go-to places, but man, that was my joint when I was.
Oh man, if you were working in finance in 2001, 2000,
yeah,
that would be the place to go.
Yeah, is it still there?
Oh yeah,
it's
yeah.
Got to be.
Oh, they swear by it. Like I worked with a number of like 21, 22 year olds just out of college, and you know, joined the consulting firm in there. You know, you try to get them to go out and they'd be like, oh, I got to go to the BHP. Come on. Don't do the same thing every night.
Yeah. Getting their $2 draft. I think my name is written on one of the bricks somewhere. I'm pretty sure of it. Yeah. All this technology to me is coming at I think my generation, meaning the tail end of the Generation Xers, we really appreciate and enjoy the technology because we're kind of a unique generation in that the first 15 years of our life, we didn't have all this, you know, and it sounds silly to say, cause you know, I'm 40, I'm not that old, but you know, my first TV was, you were still, you know, turning the dial, mm-hmm. We had rabbit ears and stuff. And so I've gone from that to in college we used the internet, but it was mostly, I graduated in 99, so it was all dial-up. So to get the best dial-up, mm-hmm. especially if you didn't have it in your dorm or your house or whatever, you just went to the library, and that's where everyone used giant computers. And again, you know, not that long ago, I guess 17-18 years ago, yeah, I guess that is a long time, so we knew how much, we didn't miss it when we didn't have it, but then when we had it, we learned to appreciate where things are now because of how much they sucked 15 years ago. And now with all right. the technology and how this shit's coming out, like, I mean, you're talking 2 years, the technology that jumps up in that short amount of time is astronomical. So we're truly, truly appreciating what technology can do for us versus someone that was just born into it. Or an old
one. Older folks, you know, they're not getting it.
No, they're just scared. At least of it. You know?
Yeah. And but wait, just paraphrase what you're saying. Like, in many ways, you know, how do you appreciate something that's always been there?
Right.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Like, if it's black and white, I guess I'm going back to your analogy here that, you know, maybe for these new kids, you know, the whole world is gray.
Sure.
You know, they never had it off. It's always been on.
And that could be a problem for a couple of reasons. I think when you're always on, people's lives are almost becoming like the Truman Show, except Truman didn't know what was going on. They know what's going on. So it kind of breeds a narcissism that I don't think existed ever to the level as we see it now.
Oh, I would suspect that humans have always had that narcissistic tendency, and maybe this is just the venue or the outlet that it's being funneled. I don't know.
Are you saying Shakespeare could have been a narcissist just because he had the ability to get his works out via the printing press?
he took steps to become what he did in order to fulfill some end. Maybe it was a, you know, an artistic aspiration, and maybe it was something else narcissistic.
Yeah. I mess around. I'm on the verge of launching a YouTube channel, and just whenever you want to do something, you have to immerse yourself. And if you want to write, read as much as you can. If you want to do a podcast, you got to listen to, you don't have to, but you're not going to be successful unless you're listening to, say, 10 different podcasts in a given week, just to hear other people do it and hear other production value and stuff like that. So with YouTube, I've just been absorbing myself into, you know, flipping through different channels and seeing how people do stuff. And there is a ton of people out there who walk around with the camera and just bullshit about nothing. And important. And it's sad. It almost makes me feel sad that these people, what would happen if, God forbid, North Korea sends a nuke over here and we get with a, what do they call it? An EMP.
Yeah.
And all our stuff shuts down. I think we'll see a jump in suicide rates. Cause people are like, well,
maybe if you conditioned yourself to be fully validated by, you know, the likes and follows of internet people, then yeah, I mean, you're going to hit a cliff at some point. Right. Yeah. So whether it be, no internet, whether it be a nuke from Korea, whether it be you get old and irrelevant, you're going to hit that cliff. I don't want to cast them in too bad a light because, you know, I think the world's divided in many ways into two types of people. You got content producers and content consumers. And, you know, on a very basic level, any content that is produced is probably, mediocrely valuable, especially to that person.
Yeah. When people ask me about starting a podcast, I say that, you know, first off, don't look at the numbers, you know, cause your first year, you're just going to be, you get one download and someone's listening to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, the way technology works and the fact that we can take a little piece of plastic and talk to the entire world in our own radio show, you should be thrilled that you are reaching someone that you would have otherwise no way of reaching, except if you were a pen pal, so even 100, if you had 100 listeners, those are 100 people that you're engaging in a conversation with and they can engage back.
That's on some level it's valuable regardless of whatever it is that they're putting out there.
Yeah. What do you think about social media and the fact that people seem to surround themselves with only validating information, or like, let's say you're a certain political, you know, you're affiliated with a certain political view, and all the people that you connect with on social media are on that political view, and the blogs that you read are on that political view, and so all you're doing is getting validated with all your thoughts, and you're not experiencing debate, you're not experiencing dissent. You know, I've had my mind changed 1.5 million times in my lifetime just by talking with people and saying, hey, wow, I never looked at it that way. That's fantastic.
I mean, one of the reasons that I wanted to kind of make this a little different in that I didn't want to give out my name and I didn't want to, have it be a cult of personality or anything like that. Not that it would ever get big enough to be, but is just that. I think social media is overwhelmed with people trying to Instagram their way to fame, or only project the best side of things, or only, you know, post the pictures that will get the most likes. And I don't know how I put it earlier, but I think that there's some sort of, I mean, we talked about narcissism. There is certainly a narcissism involved in that. And I think that, it's probably not 100% good. It's not 100% good for sure. And then the second point that you mentioned was this sort of tribalism that's going on, where everybody has a microphone, right? That's it. That's the big change from before, where only a few people had a microphone. Now everybody has a microphone.
That's right.
And not always the best people have a microphone. Nope. And the people that want to listen to the person that's not the best also congregate in groups and talk to each other.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's humanity. Like, that's probably happened for 20, 30,000 years. You get people that have the same views together, and they sort of reinforce those views and dismiss everybody else. And I think that history has shown that outcomes are not good when that happens.
No. I mean, you just look at what's going on in all these, I don't know what you even call them, these skirmishes between what I see is the far left and the far right, because there's no desire to talk. It's, you know,
no.
I'm going to go down there. I'm going to state my point. I'm going to bring a baseball bat and pepper spray.
Yep. No, exactly. And actually, one of my polls was, where should I go? And it was like, I think it was Portland, Tucson, Kansas City, and somewhere else. Right. And Portland won. Oh, it was Alaska. So Portland, Kansas City, Tucson, or Alaska. And I figured Alaska would win.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Alaska had a huge lead. But at the last second, Portland came up. So I ended up in Portland. I landed, and this is a long story, but I'll get to how it ties back to what you said.
Okay.
I landed in Portland, and it was the Rose Festival or something. And you know, the city was alive, and there was a parade and all this great stuff happening. And I was like, wow, I really lucked out. I ended up, based on random chance of a few votes, I ended up in this great atmosphere in this city I hadn't been to. And you know, I had a great time that night. And I woke up the next morning, actually had a couple of drinks at a great bar in Portland. And I woke up the next day a little bit hungover. Mm-hmm. I got out of bed. I said, it's time to see Portland. And I walked out, and I started, and often what I do, and I learned this from working in sort of researchy type field in all these countries, is, you know, follow people. Where are people going? Let's observe what's going on. So I ended up following people, and I ended up in a park. I forget the name of the park, but there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people dressed all in black. Head to toe.
Antifa.
Antifa. Yep. And they had their bandanas on and their, you know, the hoodies up, and you couldn't tell anything. I was like, wow, this is kind of cool. Like, what's going on here? And because I think seeing these things is unusual, and I appreciate that. And I hung out there and sort of mingled around, but eventually I made it to the front of that group, and across the street was I don't know what it was. It was a right to free speech group, and it was a sort of an alt-right, or I think alt-right had sort of co-opted it, group, and they were essentially just shouting across the street with, you know, police in, you know, full riot gear in the middle of them, and they were shouting insults at each other across the street. Middle finger, F you, fuck you, all these things, and, you know, calling them Nazis and calling them communists, and I killed communists, and Nazis right. Go home, and all this stuff. And it was just like, you know, have you ever really sat down and have, you know, that's a human over there, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever tried to engage with them, or is it just, you know, this craziness that I observed? And eventually something happened. I think somebody on the Antifa side threw a brick, and the whole side that I was on got tear gassed. And luckily, there were people there handing out bandanas. So I was the only one not in a bandana. I was like in jeans and a t-shirt. I looked totally out of place. So I grabbed a bandana and sort of retreated with everybody. But after I retreated, I went over to the other side. And I started speaking with and talking to some of the people on the other side. And you get to see, you got the same feeling, like, you know, this is a battle, this is a war. These people are trying to bring down our country, and those people are awful. And but as I was leaving, the two groups kind of met, and it was just like a shouting match. And I tried to, I mean, not that I was successful, but I tried to like say, hey, listen, you know, this isn't the end of the world. Like, you have these set of beliefs, you have these set of the beliefs. There's no reason, you know, for physical violence, let alone verbal abuse.
Yeah.
And like, I think that is missing, and that's sort of engendered a lot by these tribes on the internet, like whether it be Twitter or I guess Facebook now too. So, I mean, if you actually sit there and listen to both of them, you could probably extract a few good points from each one, but that's never going to happen the way it's set up now.
Yeah. The other thing too is people have been hiding behind pseudonyms and stuff. So like, if I'm on YouTube, well, not me, but you know, let's say someone's on YouTube and they're watching a video, they'll just tear apart that video. You know, this sucks. You're blah, blah, blah. You're fat. You're, and they almost get, I don't know, maybe you get desensitized to just being horrible to other people. And then you get out in the real world, and this is how you deal with dissent, is to tear them apart. And
yeah, it manifests itself in the real world, which is terrible. But, you know, that point about like this, like human social structures were designed to have some sort of repercussions for misbehavior.
Right.
Right. And that is totally missing from a lot of the online interactions that go on, where, you know, before, when you lived in a community and you misbehaved or you said something, that person knew your name and that person knew your family, and, you know, there was some sort of repercussion for that. In this digital age, that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
But the majority of the experiences that I've had with the people that have interacted with me or followed me has been, I mean, there's only one thing that pops out as a bad one, but, you know, thousands, if not more, 10,000 really great interactions. So
yeah.
I mean, can it change? Probably. But there has been a piece removed from the way humans have existed for many, many, many years, where there are no repercussions for that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and the only repercussions that seem to be are the ones that are happening at the moment through these impassioned, violent outbursts when someone doesn't see them eye to eye. I just totally drew a blank. I was reading something that you had wrote, and hold on, let me look real quick. That's funny. I kind of changing course a little bit. Something that you said, one of the reasons why you decided to do this is because you wanted to challenge yourself mentally and physically.
Right.
And I guess this can piggyback on our last idea that, you know, we are the first. And when I say we, now I'm talking Generation X, Generation whatever the next one is, even baby boomers to some extent. We are a group of humans that forgot what suffering was. You know, we might have our own little suffering. You know, I don't know, my car broke down and it was raining or something like that. But, you know, we come from a line of beings who take the farmer who lived probably on this land that I live now in North Carolina. 100 years ago, if he had a bad crop, it meant, how the hell am I going to feed my family this winter? And chances are they didn't, and that's why children died. You know, they starved to death. They weren't healthy, and that suffering is just for a good reason, but it's just no longer there. And I think it takes a little bit out of our maybe appreciation, or maybe it's supposed to be there. Maybe we're supposed to need it, and we just don't have it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I was getting at there, well, I mean, your point is completely valid. Like, I'm living in an apartment building that's been constructed in a city that's been set up in order to minimize risk,
right?
Minimize suffering, minimize anything that could possibly go wrong. There's police, firemen, everything, all risks are being taken out of life in many ways. And I think when I wrote that, I felt maybe I didn't attach it to that point exactly, but I feel like you have to have these mental challenges. You have to have these physical challenges. And then that gets back to the relationships that you have. Like, you have this relationship with your body. You have this relationship with your mind. You have to work out those muscles in many ways.
Yeah.
You have to, and I mean, all those pieces go into who you are. So if you've never suffered, or you never felt mental anguish, or you know, anything like that, you may not have. I mean, maybe this is a little bit cynical, but you may be missing something.
Sure. I think we are, because it's what got us to this point. You know, we started, I don't know what the number is, 200,000 years ago, and made it to today because of suffering. You know, it wasn't because of good times, because suffering, if you survived that, you made it past. If you didn't survive it, obviously we wouldn't be here right now. So, so it's definitely ingrained.
But suffering.
Go ahead.
Yeah, suffering for suffering's sake is not, I don't think, aspiration for humanity. I think.
Right. I guess it's. Here.
We have reached a point in humanity where we can, you know, take a little bit from here, take a little bit from here, and, you know, minimize risk of that suffering and those mental challenges or physical challenges, whatever they may be, and incorporate it into ourselves. And hopefully that makes you a little bit better person, makes you a better person within society and so on. But yeah, I definitely think that's a valid point.
Yeah, you can't say let's shut down shipments of food to North Dakota because we want them to just suffer a little bit just so they can appreciate it when they do get it. You're right, you have to kind of find it in your life. That's where
you have to seek it out. Like, you have to seek out challenge. And right. I don't know if suffering is the right word, but challenge.
Right.
I would definitely.
How about like discomfort, and then the you need to have the motivation to continue. Something as simple as yoga, I think, can give you that. I know, you know, you're not climbing Mount Everest or something, but putting yourself in a position that your muscles aren't used to being in. Because I've done all different, you know, types of. I've used to bicycle. I used to row. I used to last year I was in this weightlifting thing, and now I've gotten into more of a yoga thing. But every single time, that the commonality of all that is, when you're done with it, the feeling that goes over your body is I don't know, your body's just like, oh, thanks for that. And it sucks, especially with yoga. I mean, when you're in a position, you're like, I can't do this. But to me, that feeling after a yoga session is akin to, I don't know, anything else that's pleasurable in life. I mean, your body literally glows after it. And I don't know if it's because of the mind-body aspect. You're conscious, you're thinking about it, and you're performing it. And that might be why I find it more a holistic way to recharge your body versus putting on a headphone or headset and running on a treadmill for 2 hours and not thinking. You know what I mean?
Right.
But yeah,
I think that you can get that in many ways. I mean, a lot of people do it running. A lot of people do it through exercise or gym or whatever it is. And one of the things that I didn't know starting this out that I'd be hiking through, you know, Utah in the middle of the, essentially in the middle of the night by myself. And when you're doing that, you're like, wow, this is sketchy. This isn't comfortable for me.
Right.
And you get through it and you're like, okay, maybe I won't do exactly that again, or maybe I won't make those exact choices, but there's something that came out of that.
Yeah.
You know, there's something there that you incorporate.
Yeah, you could die. But that,
yeah, you could die. I mean, the risk of death is there. I mean, it's minimal, but if a mountain lion comes, I actually did see a mountain lion. So if a mountain lion comes out, you know, you got to know, you gotta know what to do, and your getting out is even more rewarding, I guess.
Do you have a history in hiking? Are you a hiker, or are you just throwing yourself out there?
No, I mean, recent history only. Like, I guess I grew up in Vermont. I did a lot of hiking, but we did I guess you call her fiance at this point, and I did Kilimanjaro. We did some hiking in Indonesia. So we've done we did the Himalayas. So we've done a few things recently, but. Not a technical climber or anything. It's more like a day tripper or some backpacking.
What was the hardest trip you've taken since you've done this this experiment, we'll call it?
Oh, man. The hardest one?
The one where you're like, wow, I bit off a lot on this.
I think it was the Utah one where I was in... I'd planned to go to Zion and ended up showing up really late, and I got this recommendation. I was talking to somebody and she said, listen, you should go out here and watch the sunset. And I got out, I drove out to the trailhead, and it was basically sunset then. And I was like, well, I'm going. And I sort of disregarded the mile markers and how long the hike was. And I ended up out in some canyon a little too late. And, it was a little bit sketchy. It wasn't like physically hard, but it was mentally, like, you know,
yeah,
it was out there. Yeah, so because you kind of think of the wild animals, you kind of think about losing the trail, I didn't have a tent or anything like that because I was day packing,
but. Yeah, and it's not one of those rarities. I mean, you can probably look up right now, and in the last week someone's died hiking somewhere.
Right.
I mean, it happens.
Yeah, this was way out there in Zion. So, yeah, I mean, you can get stranded. Things happen.
Yeah.
But that's the one I could think of.
Well, you know what? You could also sit on your couch for 20 years and die of a heart attack, you know? Well, and what was your... It just took a little bit longer to die, but you weren't living. You were sitting
right,
on your couch.
Right. I mean, some of this, that would be a slow death.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember. I think I was... I've been reading this book called Homo Deus, and I think it was from that book, but the guy said, yeah, it was from that book. And at the beginning of it, he says, you know, at what point we can live forever, you know, say that they find a way to upload our brains, or they found a way to reverse aging. And then suddenly risk is now a hell of a lot more, you know, more people. He said with that, if that we ever got to that point, people would do less because you have forever to lose. You know, you have this, or even if you could live 200 or 300 years and you're only 40, you know, you have a lot to risk. Risk means a lot more. Whereas now, you know, we're going to die and we don't know when it's coming. So why not, you know, take a little risk?
Well, especially if you get some benefit out of it, right? So the risk reward. You know, if you're taking risk with no benefit, yeah, I mean, that's not ideal. But if you're getting something out of it, if you can, you know, sort of quantify that, risk is, you know, worth it.
Tell me the story about the, I think you said you saw an orca take out a seal.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite stories. That was in, I mentioned I was in Portland, and my followers had me sort of go south along the Portland coast, and I popped along the Portland coast, and I loved that. You know, I had never been there before. They have all kinds of rock formations, hiking trails, secluded beaches. There's seal and sea lion that live around there. And I had popped along there for a couple days, and then I ended up in a place called Heseta Head Lighthouse. And I said, yeah, I should probably check this out. And I walked up there. I think it was like a 30-minute hike off the road. I walked up there and got up there, and it was probably close to dusk. It was getting to be dusk. And I got there and it was a lighthouse. It wasn't that impressive. Like,
yeah.
It's a building. It's kind of been refurbished. It looks like concrete. So I was a little bit disappointed in it. I was by myself. I looked out to sea and I saw this black fin sort of racing across the, you know, racing between the waves. And then I saw this big splash. And I was like, what is that? What have I just seen? And I was like, well, like probably it could be an orca. So I kind of lost sight of it at that lighthouse location. So I sort of booked it down, got back into my car and drove about a half mile up the road to this big overlook, a cliff. And I saw a pod of orca up there.
That's
awesome. I got a camera out. And at that point, I didn't have good zoom or anything, but I, you know, set it up and I saw this orca pod take down a seal, and totally random, caught my eye. And you see this like sort of incredibly rare sighting, and there was two females, a male and a baby orca out there, and.
How could you tell?
You could tell only the size and the fin. So I kind of researched afterwards.
Yeah.
So the long sort of straight black fin is the male. And then they had two swept back fins. That was a female.
Okay.
And they just hung out there and they I guess, ate the kill and there were seagulls everywhere. And then they started, after they finished, they started heading north again. So I got in my car and tried to drive out.
Yeah.
Drive, like pass them and pull over and look. And I was able to do that a number of times and they kept coming up the coast and like really close to the shore. I thought it was really good. I mean, I'm a huge whale fan, killer whale or orca. So it was very cool. I guess I called it in because you're supposed to report orca sightings. And they said, wow, we only get about four of those a year in Oregon. So
that's cool. There's your payoff, you know,
right?
I mean, cause that's something you're going to take with you for the rest of your life. That's
right.
That's pretty awesome. That's what I always thought.
Yeah, the payoff there.
Well, I was just going to say, that's, you know, people are always, you know, wanting NASA to discover alien planets or some alien life form. And people don't realize that the majority of the Earth we haven't seen, you know, and it's
right.
We can't go because we just, and our bodies don't work that way. So there's aliens and monsters all around us. You just have to know when to look. And
you just have to look.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You just have to look because you're going to see something. If you're out there, if you're truly getting out there in the wild and you keep your eyes open, eventually you're going to see something.
Yeah.
And like, I think 2 days later I was sitting in Klamath at the Klamath River Delta in Northern California, and I saw a fin whale essentially just hitting the surf, scooping up lamprey eels as he went through the surf.
Wow.
Never seen anything like that. And then I got out and took some pictures. There's a crazy guy there. He was shouting, The whales have returned to take back the earth from the human captors.
See, I would have struck up a conversation with them. That's gold right there.
I was focused on the whales and I think he had other things to do, including smoking.
Yeah.
Things. But you know, I packed up and I turned around and there were two baby bear cubs in a tree.
Oh,
yeah. So if you keep your eyes open, you can, and you're out there, you can see like things you'll never see, not doing that.
Yeah. And it really, it puts perspective into these little problems that we think we have in life. You know, when people get all bent out of shape because they cracked the screen on their cell phone or I don't know, dented their car, you know, picture being that lamprey. I mean, what's your,
I met some fishermen there too. And they were like, these things are fucking delicious.
The lamp ring there?
Oh yeah, yeah. They were out there with essentially like harpoons, and the lampreys don't swim that well. And when the tide's right, they get washed up on the shore. So they would harpoon the lamprey and throw it into a bucket and cook it up.
Where was this? Yeah. Where did you see this?
The head of the Klamath River in Northern California, of all places. I was actually there for a totally different reason, which I think is another really cool aspect of this, which is it's not the destination, right? I was there looking for there was apparently an old sort of radar station circa World War II or something, in case the Japanese flew planes over, that was hidden in the forest and camouflaged as essentially houses. So I was there trying to find that.
Yeah.
And I found the whale, found the bear, and I found the fisherman.
That's cool. So,
the uncertainty of life, right?
They have lamprey up in New England. There's the Lamprey River there where my school, I went to University of New Hampshire. I don't know if they're still there. It might be something that's not there anymore, but they're crazy looking things, and I've never considered catching one or eating it. So
yeah, there's a picture on the Twitter where he pulled it out. I mean, it must have been in there for an hour. He pulled it out and the thing like immediately started trying to find something to suck the blood out of. So it was still alive and like, plunging its head at various people and inanimate objects, trying to suck.
I got to find that tweet. When was that?
I could.
I mean, you don't have to say the day, but I mean,
if it would have been like day 30. It would have been like day 30. I think we're on day 40, 45 or 46 at this point. So it would have been day 30.
Yeah, I'll check that out. Any interest in writing about this? Writing a book, writing a blog, doing something like that?
Well, I mean, I kind of feel like the blog is on Twitter. I mean, I have the Instagram and the Facebook.
Right.
I don't know. I didn't get into it with a lot of planning, which is kind of par for the course for the whole principles of it, right? So yeah. I didn't to do anything. I just planned to see what happened. So maybe something comes out of it. I talked to my fiance, and she said, "Yeah, why don't you put it down on paper or something?" And see what, but you know, there's more to come, I'd say, before I make any decisions on that.
Well, just checking out your Instagram and stuff, you're talented at words, so I think telling your story would be worth it. I mean, just for the fact that it's an interesting story. I mean, it's modern day adventure that we don't really have too many of those anymore.
I'll take it under advisement.
Yeah. All right. Jesse, I've taken well over an hour of your time here, so I appreciate it. Appreciate your story.
No, I had fun. It's good.
Yeah. I'm going to continue to check out your Twitter, and I'll vote on some places. And
up next is getting married. So
yeah. Good luck with that one. That's always a weird thing. You know, when did monkeys decide to get a government to come in here and check off on spending the rest of their life together?
I know.
Hey, I did it myself, and it's bizarre. I don't know. We could get into an hour conversation about marriage and what it is, but
you can have me back on that after a month or two.
It's worth it, though. It's worth it because you literally, I don't know how to say this without it sounding cheesy, but you're literally combining two lives and your decisions become one, you know, you're never, everything that you decide to do, you take in account somebody else. And then, if you have kids, it only gets, you know, deeper there. And if you have more kids, I mean, it's definitely a growing experience as a person. You know, some people.
Well, I mean, doesn't that get to all our conversation today? Like, you need to take into you bring all these various experiences, whether it be your physical challenges, your mental challenges, living in a city, going out into the middle of nowhere, bringing somebody else into your life.
Yeah.
I mean, it all makes you a better person, right?
So. Sure, it does. Makes you more sensitive to other people's feelings. That's for sure. Because when you're only checking out for number one, and then you finally, and that's, I'm going to tell you right now, that's a learning experience. just take a look. I don't know.
I'm happy to try. Yeah. Happy to learn.
I don't know if your grandparents are still alive or if your parents, but take a look at the old people in your life who are married. And I don't know. You just learn a lot by that. You learn a lot by their interactions. Most of the time, all the old people in my family, the guys fall asleep while the women talk. But all right, Jesse. So at @wayward_1, that's pretty much where we catch you, right?
@wayward_. I'm still waiting for the @wayward. Yeah.
So. Why did I think there's why did I think there was a one there?
Okay. So yeah, I have to, I mean, I really, the planning was not there, which is apropos for the whole wayward thing.
Yeah.
But it's @wayward_ on Twitter.
Okay.
@wayward1 on Instagram.
Okay. I get it. Hey, another idea too is if you enjoy interacting with people via social media, and you enjoy your trips and you enjoy telling people about it, you could also do and I hate it when people give me ideas to do, but what the hell, I'll do it to you. Almost like you could do a travel journal, turn this into your next venture. You know, I guarantee you it is a possibility to make that a career, to basically travel and record it.
That'd be cool. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
We'll see where it goes.
That's right.
I will see what happens, what's around the next corner.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jesse, and safe travels.
Cheers. Thanks.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast. And at WWI Podcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.